I've got a gal named Willie Mae, and she lives in the Lolo land. I've got a gal named Willie Mae, Lord, and she lives in the Lolo land. Lord, the way I got that woman out of class, stole her from a man. All my life, baby, you know I've had to roam. All my life, baby, you know I've had to roam. Lord, just on account of me breaking up one poor man's home. Willie Mae, Willie Mae, Willie Mae, don't you hear me calling you? Lord, if I don't get my Willie Mae out of class, ain't no other woman will do. When I get it thinking about Willie Mae, cold chill run up and down my spine. When I get it thinking about Willie Mae, cold chill run up and down my spine. Lord, sometimes I wished I was dead, but Willie Mae, you know I'm afraid of dying. I'm gonna leave here, I'm going on down the line. I'm gonna leave here, baby, and I'm going on down the line. Willie Mae, you know I don't do nothing here, Lord knows, but grieve and cry. Lord knows, baby, but grieve and cry.
Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner. And tonight, part three of three, we can say officially. And wow, 3 hours is even then really just an introduction to the wonderful life and work, the life and times and music of Big Bill Brunze. We are continuing our exploration of his history, mirroring and paralleling the wonderful book, I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunze, by our guest, Bob Reisman. And we opened our show today with an original, Willie Mae, W-I-L-L-I-E-M-A-E, of Brunze's, and a fascinating song, as with so many, because you have both the possible autobiographical elements in it, and also where it fits in both in his musical life and in his biographical life. And that right there gives you everything from Lee Bradley, as he was as a young man in Arkansas, to collaborations later with Pete Seeger, and both Lee and Pete being in the Midwest at Circle Pine Center, very much connected to Chicago and the cooperative movement, and. Bob, thanks so much for joining us for this third hour and discussion of the latter part of Big Bill Brunze's life, the 1950s here in Chicago and outside of Chicago and across the ocean as well. Tell us your take on Willie Mae.
This was a song that entered Bill's repertoire in the 1950s, the early 1950s. And it was a period where he was very much straddling several different worlds. He had spent several decades as one of the most prolific, prominent, popular, successful performers in the blues world, with the great majority of his music being in the form of records that were bought by African-American communities around the country. And starting in the years just at the end of World War II, he had shifted to his repertoire and the instrument that he played. He switched to an acoustic guitar, and he switched increasingly, not exclusively, but increasingly to becoming a solo performer. What this enabled him to do was, in the 1950s, to play a crucial role as a trailblazer in developing an international audience for the blues. So this is a period where Bill was recording at times for Mercury Records in Chicago, and he would do sessions where some of those songs would be for African-American audiences and some of them would be directed more towards his newly acquired white audiences. In 1951, to describe Bill's role and to describe the set of attributes that he had that equipped him to be so successful in being what's been described as really the first ambassador of the blues is wonderfully illustrated by what happened when he first came to England. This is the end of his first tour in the summer of 1951. And he had performed in France. He had performed in Germany. He had recorded in France. And he arrives in England the end of September to play a gig there. And what you can see if you look through the contemporary British music press, the magazines like Jazz Journal, the newspapers like Melody Maker, what you see is Bill starts giving interviews. And what he does with these interviews occurs on many levels, which is characteristic of Big Bill. He certainly wants to make sure that anyone who might be interested in purchasing a ticket to come see Big Bill Brunsey will take advantage of that opportunity and have compelling reasons for that decision and to come and see him. At the same time, he also positions himself as someone who can describe to the jazz writers. It's a jazz press at this point. The blues hadn't really taken off because Big Bill was the first artist to have extended residencies, blues artists.
Whereas jazz had been happening over there pretty much from the beginning. I mean, from very, very early, certainly from World War I.
Right, onward.
On.
Right.
Yeah.
So what Big Bill, as he spoke with the writers like Max Jones, who went on to really, at that time, were well established and became even more prominent over time, Bill would describe the world that the blues came from. He would describe the rural setting, the American South. He would identify that this was often a difficult and a challenging life for African Americans to make a living. And he would say, in order to sing what he called the real blues, and he always described himself as a blues singer. And he said, to sing the real blues, you have to have lived in this world. You have to have plowed behind a mule. You have to have worked chopping cotton. And he said, and that's conveyed unmistakably in the music. And so he then became a go-to source for the people who wrote about music in a way that would influence and help to create a passionate audience for blues. And then he took it one step further. He identified by name the next cohort of singers, who in fact it would take the better part of a decade, sometimes more for some of them, to travel over to England. But he said, if you want to hear, there's another one coming along and he'll be over here not long after me. Named Muddy Waters. And he mentioned Muddy by name. So what Bill did, it wasn't just that he was a charismatic and compelling performer. He was quite conscious of the status that he had and the way he could use it to open doors and to create an awareness and a passion, ultimately, in the minds of European fans as they became blues fans, to see those artists who would then tour successfully in the decades to come.
Because humans tend to put things in categories, and because we go back within our own received histories and our own lineages of listening to music or of following the culture, there are many people who know of Big Bill from his involvement in the folk world and in politics. There are many people who know of Muddy Waters both for blues and because of his role as an antecedent/colleague of the rock world and the rock guitar world. And they don't realize. I mean, I've seen people who say, you know, I saw the picture of Muddy Waters as a pallbearer for Big Bill Brunsey with Studs Terkel and Win Strachey, and it didn't fit to them. And you say, you know, not only that, but it wasn't like Muddy Waters drove up for the funeral. This was somebody who was being schooled by, in his own words, by Brunsey. I mean, this was a connection that within, that's really the forgotten part of all these overlaps, is that, you know, blues for a black audience taking place in the 1940s and early 1950s. Right. That's something that is just hasn't been, until your book and some other studies, looked at, whether by black authors, white authors, rock, blues, or folk. And that's another reason that your book, I think, is so important, because you show us that not only the many strands of Big Bill's life, but the many strands of the development of popular musics, plural, which is something we love to talk about, musics, plural, on this program. The other thing, of course, that comes out of that song is technical stuff, and just the way, I think Pete Seeger said something like, Bill has a thumb like a rock or whatever. I mean, that he could be his own bass with this, and we hear that. We'll come back to that, but we should get to some more music. Stand Your Test in Judgment.
This is a song that came into Bill's repertoire in the 1950s as he was performing for white audiences. He was often advertised overseas in Europe as singing some combination of blues, folk songs, work songs, and spirituals. And in many of his interviews with Studs Terkel and with Alan Lomax, and particularly with Studs, he would stress that the roots of blues go back to spirituals. And now, Bill was also very clear that he himself was not someone for whom organized religion
Right.
was an integral part of his life. In fact, he always described his mother as being a very strong church-oriented woman, and his father in the same way. And he told anecdotes, which may or may not have reflected the specifics of those personalities, but conveyed, as Studs would say, as Studs did say, Big Bill is always telling the truth, his truth, mm-hmm. And that his mother would become irritated with any family members who would play songs that appeared to verge on blues. So Bill said his mother really never heard him perform until much, much later in his career. But as Bill said, I don't hold much stake in that view of the world. But he said those people, meaning people who believe in a Christian faith, have as much likelihood of being right for their beliefs as I have in my beliefs. Mm-hmm. And he said that a number of times. And I think that reflects a genuine sense of his worldview, which is that he respects that there are differences. And to the extent we can appreciate and acknowledge that, we'll all be better off. And so he incorporated a number of songs that drew on spirituals in his repertoire. And this one, I think, is a particularly engaging one.
Man, you got to stand your test in judgment. Man, you got to stand there for yourself. Ain't nobody here gonna stand there for you. Now, brother, you got to stand there for yourself. Man, you got to pray for your sin. Man, you got to pray for yourself. I don't claim nobody here gonna pray for you. Oh, brother, you got to pray for yourself. Now you got to cry with your troubles. Man, you got to cry for yourself. Lord, it ain't nobody here gonna cry for you. Lord, you got to cry for yourself. Now you got to cross the river of Jordan. Man, you got to cross that for yourself. Ain't nobody here gonna cross that for you. brother, you got to cross, cross that for yourself. Man, you got to lay, lay down and die. Man, you got to lay, die for yourself. Ain't nobody here gonna lay that for you. Now, brother, you got to lay that for yourself. Man, you got to go, go and meet your maker. Man, you got to go, that for yourself. Ain't nobody here gonna go that for you. Lord knows you got to go, that for yourself. Man, you got to die and go away. Man, you got to die and go away. Ain't nobody gonna go that for you, brother. You got to die for yourself.
Interesting, too, isn't it, that speaking of studs and WFMT and history, Richard Dyer Bennett, who was British-born and initially trained minstrel, his words, who became an American folk sensation. Of course, he recorded the version of that as Lonesome Valley, and that was the sign-off for decades for Norm Pellegrini and Ray Nordstrand on the Midnight Special, his version, which has a lot more Britishism, but also the text is very much Southern Church, white or black, and interesting how these strains can cross in other ways. Now, of course, there's Big Bill giving homage without getting into strict theology to the roots of his family, his people, and so on. But then there's also the sort of that's looking to the past away, and then there's the looking to the future from the songs that are more politically directed. And maybe you can say something about When Will I Get to Be Called a Man?
This is a song that he recorded in England. He also recorded it for Folkways Records in the U.S. And this is a wonderful example in songwriting of something that Bill did in his autobiography and many other commentaries and remembrances, but particularly his autobiography, Big Bill Blues. And Big Bill Blues was literally handwritten by Big Bill in hotel rooms, wherever he happened to be, his home. And he would write down his recollections, his observations, and send them to Yannick and Margot Bruneau in Brussels. And they had initiated the project, and Bill responded enthusiastically.
Now, these were his volunteer host managers in Europe, Belgium-based, and aficionados of jazz and blues. And fortunately, figuratively and literally, great documentarians. I mean, they actually made a documentary film, and they kept everything. And that's was one of the things that made your research possible, right?
No, the fact that
– And the photo collections.
Absolutely. And the photo collections were photos that they took as well as photos that Bill had given them. And no, the Bruneaus played and really continue to play. Yannick has been gone for several decades. Margot still very much alive. Their role was crucial in ensuring that Bill's creative output is as available as it is in a variety of media. And the book, in particular, Big Bill Blues, the process by which Bill's handwritten notes were then transferred or transformed, better, into a book-length autobiography is a tremendous credit to the collective effort. As Margot Bruneau says, Bill, it took a little while to figure out Bill's penmanship, and finally she said the key was to read it aloud, that
right.
Bill wrote very accurately phonetic reproductions of how he described, how he would pronounce words.
So it's not, though, just, I think, a phonemic transformation and translation. I was talking with some friends just the other day about how hard it is to sit down and read Moby Dick, but how easy it is to read Moby Dick aloud over the course of a year or whatever, because it's about expression. It's about language. And go to a Shakespeare play and then sit down and try to read separately the play, the movement of spoken language. And so it's really a discovery and an unlocking in many, many different ways. And so the song,
When Will I Get to Be Called a Man, is Bill speaking, taking on in the first person, singing as the singer, telling of the experience of fighting in, you can assign it to World War I or World War II. Stay with World War I because that's how he described it in his autobiography. And what this is characteristic of Bill. In fact, it's to me a central creative fact about Bill. What Bill would do is try to convey at this point in his career, he's increasingly speaking and performing and writing for white audiences that are less familiar rather than more familiar with the African-American experience in the United States. And so he creates composite figures. And by speaking in this case in particular and in other stories in the first person, it's a way of conveying actually a number of different levels of history in a way that doesn't feel to the listener or to the reader that they have to struggle through an academic text. They get the picture that Bill so skillfully paints, and he conveys a lot about the experiences that my best guess is that he absorbed from black soldiers returning from World War I, one of whom was his older brother who did serve in World War I.
When I was born into this world, this is what happened to me. I was never called a man, and now I'm 53. I wonder when will I get to be called a man, and try to wait till I get 93. When Uncle Sam called me, I knew I'd be called a real McCoy. And I got an army that has called me Soldier Boy. I wonder when will I get to be called a man? Do I have to wait till I get 93? When I got back from overseas, that night we had a ball. Next day I met the old boss. He said, boy, get you some overhauls. I wonder when will I get to be called a man? I do have to wait till I get 93. I worked on levy camps and extra gangs too. Black man's a boy, I don't care what he can do. I wonder when will I get to be called a man? Do I wait till I get 93? They said I was uneducated, my clothes were dirty and torn. Now I've got a little education, but I'm still a boy right on. I wonder when will I get to be called a man? Do I have to wait till I get 93?
Interesting, too. I'm thinking in the late 60s, early 70s, one of the last of the continuing doo-wop groups, the Flamingos, did a song called Buffalo Soldier, which was then remade by the neo-doo-wop Persuasions, also in the 70s. And the idea is going back further in time to the black soldiers who were sent out to fight, quote, the Indians, so the white people could stay out of this. And the refrain in that song, which they must have heard this song was Buffalo Soldier, When Will They Call You a Man? And, of course, then Bob Marley, 10 years later, does his own song along similar lines. But, I mean, that there's a prophetic aspect, I think, that runs through all of these things and then allows us to stretch the history forward and backward to say, yeah, but what about? And it in a way, it opens those doors, I think, for that. We're speaking with Bob Reisman, author of The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunze, University of Chicago Press. I Feel So Good, the title of that biography. And we're talking about Big Bill here on Critical Thinking, 98.7 WFMT Chicago and WFMT.com. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. We need to at least touch on, not in a gossipy way, but in a biographical understanding, Bill's personal life. I married more than once, right, and had at least a child in Europe who was not from a legal marriage. So give us a rundown on Bill's family life.
Very quickly, he and I found documentation supporting this. That was part of the challenge. Once I identified that he was Lee Conley Bradley, that made that task at least possible. He was married in Arkansas when he was about 17, and that marriage ended in divorce, which is documented in the Jefferson County files in 1923. Somewhere in that period, shortly thereafter, possibly, is when he moved to Chicago. What I was able to, again, determine through existing documents was that he was married in Houston in 1941 to a woman who became the first Mrs. Rose Brunze.
Right. It's also complicated because not only does his name change, does, through your research, his biography of birthplace and age change, but also he married two women named Rose.
Right. And this was when he was on tour with Lil Green in 1941. And that marriage ended in divorce in 1951 in Chicago. And again, court documents identify that. In neither of those dissolved marriages is there a mention of any children.
Right.
And so Bill described having a number of children to a variety of audiences, but I was not able to identify any documentation mm-hmm. supporting that. And let me just move ahead, and then I will describe. He did have a stepdaughter. He was married in 1956 to the second Mrs. Rose Brunze, and he remained married to her until his death, and she lived until the late 1990s
right.
in Chicago. Bill had a number of relationships with women in Europe. I didn't set out to track that any more than the story came to me on that, but there was a French woman named Jacqueline, and I mentioned that partly because she was part of his world for some period in the 1950s. And when he came back to Chicago in 1953, and as we'll get to this in a moment, he recorded for Chess Records. He recorded a song in her honor, directed mm-hmm. to her, called Jacqueline. Then in 1955, when he traveled to Holland to perform there, not his first trip to Holland, he met a Dutch woman named Pim van Isfeldt, and they fell in love. They had a relationship, and that relationship produced a child, Michael van Isfeldt, who is very much alive and well and in Amsterdam.
And Big Bill stayed in contact, at least both in person when he could and by mail, until his death with them.
Right, exactly. Right. No, there was the Bill.
This wasn't just a drive-by or something.
No.
They really had a relationship.
That was what I learned about Big Bill, is that he was a prolific letter writer. And he wrote to Win Strachey. He wrote to Alan Lomax. And he carried on correspondence with people with whom he had both personal and professional connections, this being the 1950s. He had to write in advance of any gigs that he might arrange on either side of the ocean, depending on where he was. I was fortunate enough to visit Pim Van Isfelt, and she brought out a shoebox. It was filled to the brim with letters and cards. And this was a connection that was, to the best of my ability to determine it, and to hear Pim describe Bill in terms that conveyed some of the challenges and difficulties that she and they faced, and particularly after Bill passed away, when she was now raising Michael as a single mother.
She's raising a biracial boy, fortunately, at least in Amsterdam, which was then and remains even more so somewhat open, but still also Dutch can be very closed to, and she's a single mother without recourse. I mean, he's gone.
Right.
You know? He's no longer living. He's
right.
He's abandoned them, quite the opposite.
And at the same time, she also remembered fondly and fully acknowledged the good times that they did have together.
Mm-hmm. How many trips total did Bill make to Europe, as far as you know?
Half a dozen.
Yeah, okay.
And first one was in 51, and then the last one was in 57.
Okay.
And then he became too ill to travel
so
back.
So pretty much, had he not been ill, this would have two sides of the ocean would have continued professionally and personally for him, because things were clicking.
There's every reason to believe that the trajectory was
very,
there was a lot of momentum, and the trajectory was upward, no question.
Tell us about the next song, which in some ways relates to some of this narrative.
This is one of the songs that Bill recorded for Chess Records. It's called Romance Without Finance. It shows that his ability to write a song which was primarily directed to African-American audiences as opposed to songs of social significance is undiminished at this point in his career. And that session was really, it was in the spring of 1953. It was really the last session of music that he recorded with a focus on an African-American audience.
But up until that moment, he is still very much going back and forth across the ocean and going back and forth across genres. And as you said, he's able to do here in 53 what he was doing in 23 and 24 and 27. So
he put together, he inserted a character in his autobiography that he named Uncle Jerry Belcher. Now, his mother's family name was Belcher. However, of family members I've discussed this with, none of them are familiar with an Uncle Jerry. There's no documentation in the official sources. But once again, I think what Bill did was come up with a composite figure, which is an indelible image that stays with you. And his Uncle Jerry would dispense philosophical wisdom, probably not unlike the kind that Bill dispensed. Bill described working as a preacher, which is quite credible given his skills, his intelligence, and his comfort level in being a public figure down in Arkansas. But he also had gotten an opportunity to play music professionally for a gig, and he was challenged by deciding which of the two. And he said, his Uncle Jerry came to him and said, you're sitting on top of the fence, you're straddling the fence, you got to pick one side or the other. So this was Romance Without Finance being the last session when he was primarily focused on recording for a black audience.
Drink till you get your fill. Don't forget, baby, you gotta have money when it's time to pay the bill. Romance without finance, baby, don't mean a thing, now can't you see? Sitting there, baby, with your hair all down. Ain't spent a dime, baby, but you say you're painting the town. Romance without finance. Now look here, baby, I want to give you a hint. You can hide romance, baby, just give me them dead presidents. Romance without finance don't mean a thing, now can't you see? Yeah, romance without finance, baby, don't mean a thing, now can't you see?
Romance without finance, Big Bill Brunzi singing his song with Lee Cooper and perhaps some others from the Chess stable. Chess Records being the local label that the Chess, as they came to be known, brothers had, and really an empire of blues and black popular music that this Jewish family presided over on South Michigan or South Wabash?
It was on Cottage Grove, and then
Originally, you're right. It was further south.
It went to South
Cottage,
Michigan.
And then, well, that's 20 shows in themselves about the legacy of Chess. And again, this straddling of the fence and whether Uncle Jerry emerging from him is speaking to him. But for whatever reason, he straddles back after this. And another key song in this development is Key to the Highway.
That's a wonderful entry point to talk about Bill and his colleagues and friends,
right.
Studs Terkel and Win Strachey, who were the architects of the modern era of folk music in Chicago. If there were a Big Bang event, I think you could successfully argue it was the debut of the I Come For to Sing Review at Mandel Hall at the University of Chicago in November 1947, Studs as the narrator, Win Strachey, Big Bill Brunzi, and at the time Larry Lane performing. And as Studs said, something electrifying happened. And with that momentum, that propelled that group to perform at other colleges and universities, first around Chicago and then elsewhere around the Midwest and even the country. And then when they landed a regular Monday night gig at the Blue Note nightclub, the most prestigious jazz club.
Where was the Blue Note at that point?
It moved. There were a couple of different locations, and they were all around the Clark, Madison, Dearborn area.
When there was a night scene there along Clark Street, you had movie theaters, you had clubs, you had the Greyhound station, you had seamy people, you had enterprising people looking for the next thing.
Right. And the next thing turned out to be this folk music group. They were acoustic and Studs was narrating. But Duke Ellington, when he was performing at the Blue Note, they had the Monday night slot because under the union contracts, they had to have a dark night, a night that the band during its residency would get off. And so Frank Holzfind, the owner, suggested to Studs maybe this might work. And lo and behold, what Frank in a recording of the group says was a happy experiment. It lasted a number of years. And what they found, and this is documented in the little write-up, they had a newsletter, the Blue Note News, and Duke Ellington wrote a glowing review saying, what we play in our band is folk music, just a little bit further removed than the I Come For to Sing group. And what emerged from that was this, it would be an affluent audience. It would be people with some disposable income. It would be marketing executives. It would be advertising executives.
And people who could go out on a Monday night.
That's right.
Which was not most people who couldn't even go out on a weekend night.
And so what that demonstrated to a set of entrepreneurs, as you suggest, namely Al Grossman and his business partner, Les Brown, they went to see a version of this group because they used it in some ways as an overall brand name, and then different people would perform in different mix and match groupings. So there was a performance that Al Grossman and Les Brown went to of, I think it was Big Bill and Fleming Brown, the wonderful banjo player and teacher for many years, the Old Town School. And as Les Brown said, we recognized that this was a different niche than currently existed, but they were thinking about opening a venue. So when, in fact, the opportunity presented itself for them to open the Gate of Horn in 1956, and actually Big Bill was one of the first performers sure. to perform there, that happened, or one of the factors that tipped the scales towards that entrepreneurial decision was to see that they would get repeat customers week after week after week. And then the Gate of Horn very quickly became a feature not only in the Chicago landscape, although it was definitely a venue that Chicago-based performers like Bob Gibson could come up through, but national performers such as Odetta and Josh White would perform there as well. And right. so that really helped to launch folk music as a commercial enterprise right. in Chicago and beyond, because people looked at this and said, we can do this too.
Come on, Bill.
Two guitars and a harmonica. One guitar belonged to Big Bill Brunzi, the other to Brownie McGee, and harmonica to Sonny Terry. Let's hear them play for a minute here and sing.
I've got a key to the highway. Yes, build out and I'm bound to go. I'm gonna leave you running, because walking is most too slow. I'm going down to the river. Yes, I'm gonna take my rocking chair. I might have blues and trouble. I'm gonna rock on away from here. I'm going down to the border. Yeah, baby, where I'm better known. You know I don't do nothing here, little girl. Drive a good man away.
It's about 12:40 in the morning. This will be Tuesday morning, but the right time for the blues.
It's wonderful to hear those voices, instrumental and vocal. So many of us grew up with this combination of people and also these causes, which became both commercial successes and non-commercial successes, and reintroduced streams of music back into American history. And into, so when was this session?
This session was in May of 1957. Bill had returned from what turned out to be his last trip to Europe. And Sonny and Brownie were in town because they were performing in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and they came up to visit Studs, and Studs put this impromptu gathering together. And it's also a wonderful opportunity to hear Big Bill play with another terrific blues guitarist and a superb blues harmonica player. He hadn't done that right. in some time, because at that point he was primarily playing as a solo acoustic performer.
And I can distinctly remember, and I'm sure other listeners have similar memories, having come up with This World, the University of Chicago Folk Festival, parents who'd been to the Gate of Horn, my going to Earl of Old Town, and these kinds of things, and then the South Side world that was keeping some of this stuff alive, and saying to people who wanted to, through rock, turn me on to the blues, and I'd say, well, that's great music, but that's electric blues. The blues is Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Big Bill Brunzi, and they would look at me as if I was telling them that the blues was Lawrence Welk or something. And fortunately, now these things are seen as coming together. And again, your book is a big part of that. We have to mention the Old Town School of Folk Music, because that's happening. You've got Grossman and Partners doing Gate of Horn, but then you've also got with Wynn. This not-for-profit idea, and one that has, you know, you just wish that Wynn could see where the Old Town School has gone.
Wynn wrote up an account of the Old Town School, the founding and the origins, and the first, I think, 10 years, and he called it Biography of a Hunch. And what he said.
That tells you Wynn Strachey right there in four words, doesn't it? But that the cleverness, Biography of a Hunch, and the honesty.
Right. And in fact, the Gate of Horn played a role in this, because Wynn at that point had been blacklisted, lost his children's TV show, but then had gotten another children's TV show, although they didn't pay him as well as the first time around. And he was playing and performing at the University of Chicago through the Folklore Society and other venues around Chicago. He went to the Gate of Horn. He wanted to see who was playing there. And he saw a young guitarist who had not long before then been in California, named Frank Hamilton. And he saw Frank Hamilton perform, and he thought Frank Hamilton did a very good job. Also in the audience that night at the Gate of Horn was a woman named Dawn Greening. And Dawn thought that, one, Frank was very good, she learned that Frank would, looking for a reason to stay longer in the extended stay in the Chicago area, she thought he might be someone who could teach a small group class in acoustic music. And so she invited Frank to start giving classes in the Greenings' Oak Park home. And Wynn, who was a marvelous singer, classically trained singer, but always looking to improve his guitar technique, signed up. He was part of this network. And so he went. And what he saw was that Frank Hamilton was someone who could teach a group class performing at multiple levels of skill. And as Wynn said, I had thought about the idea of a school of folk music in Chicago, and now I found someone who could teach it. And so he set up an opening night, a registration night, December 1st of 1957. And he asked Big Bill to come and be part of that opening event. And Bill was as much of a featured performer as was in a position to be there. And Bill at this point, it's December of 57, he had been operated on for the lung cancer that would eventually sadly kill him. In the operation, the doctors had nicked his vocal cords. So what that meant was he really couldn't speak above a whisper, but he could play.
Right.
And so the launch of the Old Town School featured Big Bill playing The Glory of Love, Frank Hamilton diagramming that on the on a blackboard. It's a school. You have to have a blackboard. And then a small group of potential students learning from Frank how to play what Big Bill has played. And that was the moment where they started lining up for the registration and the school was launched.
And the school then was for many years, sadly, what's now a strip mall in the 300 west block of North Avenue. But then, of course, it went on to Armitage, and now it's grown and flourishes on Lincoln Avenue, following exactly the ideas that Wynn and Frank Hamilton and Studs and Big Bill had. Let's hear that Glory of Love.
Give a little, take a little, let your poor heart bleed, baby, little butt, baby, that's the glory of love. Cry a little, sigh a little, let your cloud roll by, baby, little butt, baby, that's the glory of love. Long as there are just the two of us, have the world in its charm. Long as there are just the two of us, hold each other's arm. Baby, now win just a little, lose a little. Sometime had the blues, baby, little but baby, that's the glory of love. Long as there are just the two of us, have the world in its charm. Long as there are just the two of us, we hold each other's arm. Baby, now win just a little, lose a little. Sometime had the blues, baby, little but baby, that's the glory of love.
Again, I might sound like a broken, but I hope beautiful record. If you just took the first minute and a half of that, you have one of the greatest recordings by one of the greatest guitar players who ever lived. You have his transforming this Benny Goodman number, Peter Hill song from 1936, which we recently learned was a favorite song of Paul McCartney's father. And Paul McCartney did this album last year of songs that he grew up hearing that his father would play popular music from then. And, of course, everybody's done versions, probably most famously Jimmy Durante. But then of course, Big Bill probably got the best version of all. And on that historic night, he gave just the guitar version. Because of that. Let's hear, before we wrap up, let's hear that session or that excerpt of a session of Studs and Bill talking together before we talk about the post-vocal period for Bill.
The hardest thing in the world is try to explain your way of feeling about different things. So it's the same thing about the people in Mississippi and Arkansas and Georgia, Texas and places like that. Why they've been really tortured and done around and pushed around, and they make up their songs and they sing about it and in their churches and in their places why they sing. Well, people that have never been into them kind of thing, he don't know what's going on. He don't know. I realize it now because I've been in places where people do sing serious songs of what happened to them in their lives. Well, it didn't happen to me. I have never had a bomb to drop in Chicago. There was no bomb dropped in Mississippi or nothing like that. Well, what I know about a bomb, only time I see a bomb is a picture of it. I never saw one really in my life. Never had my hand on one, see? But those people over there, they know what it means. They see a plane, hear a plane coming over late hours at night and something fall, destroy their homes. It never does like that happen to me. So it's the same thing with them. When they're singing about those troubles they have there, the same thing with me when I sing about my trouble. My mule die, I can't even get nothing to work my farm that year, and so I lose all the cotton and everything dies. He don't know nothing about that.
This, then, is the blues, then.
That's the blues.
Singing something that is your life very close to you. You can't make it up. It has to have happened to you.
That's right. The blues come from actually life.
The blues come from actual life. I mean, that's why it's the life and music and the life and times of Big Bill Brunsey. Big Bill was making it personally, socially, musically, educationally, and heavy smoker and a very hard life of laboring work up until pretty much late in his life, having to have strenuous day jobs as well as a busy performance and travel schedule. And so at what we now know in 1958 was at the age of 55. And though, you know, 40 years of pretending you're 10 years older than you are probably takes a toll also. So as a 65-year-old man in his mind, it's a bad disease today. And 55 years ago, there was only so much that could be done. And eventually, as he's failing, when Strachey calls an ambulance to take Rose and Bill to the hospital, and he dies in the ambulance. But even in death, in the immediate follow-up to that, there's this outpouring in the press, in the black press, in the music press, and there's this choreographed sounds like there's something underhanded, but there's this appropriate ceremony organized by Win Strachey.
Well, Big Bill trusted Win Strachey enough that he made him executor of his estate. And Win took this responsibility enormously seriously. And he is someone that Bill had confided in both personally and professionally through their correspondence when Bill was overseas. This was a friendship that had been forged and reinforced over a dozen years. And so and Win getting a phone call and coming to the apartment and then going to Billings Hospital at the University of Chicago indicates the level of engagement that he had with Bill and Bill's family at that time. And Win wanted to do everything that he could to ensure that Bill's various constituencies would have an opportunity to honor him as part of mourning his loss and celebrating his life. So among other things, he moved in a bunch of ways simultaneously because they needed to work towards a memorial service and a funeral quickly. But he also tried to raise money, which he did do. He reached out to people who were in a position of enough means that they could help supplement whatever was going to come from the musicians union, the Black Musicians Union, Local 208, for Rose. And he ensured that what would be in place first at the memorial service and then at the funeral would be a professional photographer because he wanted to document this. And at the memorial service, Mahalia Jackson, with whom Bill had toured and performed in England previously, and Mahalia Jackson sang. Win played the guitar and sang. Studs Terkel spoke, and there's photographs documenting all of this. And then at the memorials, at the funeral in Lincoln Cemetery in Blue Island, what you can see there is a photograph which does accomplish what Win had hoped it would, which is that you see on one side of the casket the leaders of the white folk community in Chicago. You've got Win, you've got Studs, you've got Chet Roble, the piano player who was very much a part of I Come For to Sing. And on the other side of the casket, you've got two generations of top-tier Chicago blues performers, Sonny Land Slim, Tampa Red, with whom Bill never recorded, but with whom he was friends going back to the 1920s. Otis Spann, Muddy Waters' extraordinary piano player. And
Muddy Waters.
Well, and at the procession with his eyes downcast is Muddy Waters.
But you have the almost supreme acoustic, just man and a piano. You've got Sonny Land Slim all the way to a father of modern popular and rock music, Muddy Waters.
Yeah. Right. And the connection between Bill and Muddy was one that was over a dozen years old at that point. Bill had, to look back at his career, he had those musicians of stature, of status, help him get his start. Papa Charlie Jackson had a best-selling song, and he opened the door. He got his foot in the door for Big Bill to start recording with Ink Williams at Paramount Records in the late 1920s. What Bill did was to learn from that experience and exemplify that. And so a whole series of several generations of blues musicians have spoken about the role that Big Bill played in helping them. Many of them, most of them, came from somewhere else. They came to as Bill had come from somewhere else, as Studs and Wind had come from somewhere else. I mean, everybody needs a hand somehow. And so Big Bill had helped Muddy's guitar player, Jimmy Rogers, Little Walter, the extraordinary transformative harmonica player. And Muddy, if you listen to and read interviews that Muddy gave, he tended to be quite reserved. And when he talked about Big Bill, his tone completely shifts. Yeah. He says, some guys, when they make it, they don't look behind and help the ones who are coming along. But he said about Big Bill, that's the nicest guy I ever met.
Right. That's also a chapter title in the book, I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunze. We've shared 3 hours now, and frankly, there would be at least 3 more hours. But we also want you to read the book because it's wonderful, and it also has a lot of listening guides and information in it. I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunze, BRONZY, for those of you who are new to the world of Big Bill. Bob Reisman, RIESMAN, the author. We should say the very important popular music historian Peter Guralnick opens the book with a foreword. Pete Townsend of The Who and of guitar playing has an appreciation that starts the book. You're going to enjoy it, whether in hardcover or paperback, and you can listen and re-listen to these programs as well via our podcast and streaming and downloading information in a moment. We're going to go out with a song that so emblematic of so many things, and particularly for WFMT folks who know that it inspires one of the great radio documentaries of all time, Studs Terkel's This Train, about the train from Chicago and back at the time of the March on Washington for civil rights and jobs in 1963. And, we'll let Bob both introduce This Train and take us out of this three-hour journey with Big Bill Brunze.
This version of This Train was recorded during a 9-hour, 3-day recording session that took place in Chicago just before Bill went under the knife for the operation in the summer of 1957 that ultimately robbed him of his voice. And it was arranged by a Cleveland-based disc jockey who was very successful in the pop music field named Bill Randall. Bill Randall had grown up in Detroit and was passionate about African-American music, blues and gospel in particular. And he said he thought Big Bill Brunze was the greatest of the blues musicians, and he was in a position to arrange for and fund this session, which took place at Universal Recording Studios, which was the premier recording studio in all of Chicago, the top jazz performers, top pop performers. And he arranged for Studs to be there for much of the session. It wound up being, as Bill Randall described it, Big Bill's last will and testament. And in it, Bill plays dozens of songs and reminisces and recollects his connection and his admiration for many of the departed blues musicians whom he admires, people like Leroy Carr, people like Jim Jackson, people like Big Maceo Merriweather. And so this song, This Train, is, to me, just a wonderful example of Bill being able to combine his extraordinary vocal skills and his exceptional guitar playing. And as you listen, I hope you will think of the words of Muddy Waters when he characterized Big Bill by saying, mostly, I try to be like him.
This train don't count no gamblers, this train. This train don't count no gamblers, this train. This train don't count no gamblers, no hypocrites, no midnight ramblers, this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory. Nobody ride it but the righteous and the holy. This train bound for glory now, this train. This train is built for speed now, this train. This train is built for speed now, this train. This train is built for speed. Fastest train you ever did see now, this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train don't count no liars, this train. This train don't count no liars, this train. This train don't count no liars, no hypocrites and no bar flyers, this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train is solid black boy, this train. This train is solid black now, this train. This train is solid black. Why take you, don't come back, boy, this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train, you don't pay no transportation on this train. This train, you don't pay no transportation on this train. This train, you don't pay no transportation. There's no Jim Crow and no discrimination on this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train don't carry white or black on this train. This train don't care whether you're white or black on this train. This train don't carry white or black. Everybody ride it is treated just alike on this train. Bound for glory now, this train. This train is bound for glory now, this train. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory. Nobody ride it but the righteous and the holy. Now this train, bound for glory. Now this train. This train is bound for glory. This train. This train is bound for glory. Now this train. This train is bound for glory. This train.
A last will and testament, a summation, a synthesis of everything from spirituals through folk, through the blues, a life story, and a testament in the sense of something that we benefit from, pick up and carry on Bill's dream of a world based on people, not skin color, income, etc., and a dream that's still far away, but perhaps at least in certain ways has been realized in portion, in great part due to the work of Big Bill Brunsey, Studs Terkel, Win Strachey, and Muddy Waters, and others who lived that dream and handed off to us. And thanks to Bob Reisman, we have a guidebook, and that's just, and it's beautifully written. And you've heard the level of and depth of knowledge that Bob brings to it, and the passion and the artistry of storytelling about this. Bob, thank you so much for sharing these 3 hours with us.
Thanks so much, Andrew. This has been wonderful.
We want to thank Bob Reisman, of course, University of Chicago Press, Matt DeStefano for taking us through all these hours and making them sound great as always. Our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, other friends of this program, drop us a line, Rentap, R-E-N-T-A-P, Patner spelled backwards, at AOL.com. Chime in at WFMT.com. Navigate around anywhere you like on WFMT.com. /critical thinking, and you can experience the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.